From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. American business is rapidly changing today. That means Americans must be prepared for that change, regardless of what causes it. Today, I speak with Robert Gilbreth. He is CEO of Proudfoot Change Management, an international consulting firm. He has recently written a book about modern management. We discuss the common mistakes companies and individuals are making in these times of change. Later, I talk with Jim Ferguson. He invented the LCD, the liquid crystal display you find on many calculators and watches. He has just received his 90th patent. We talk about what life is like for an American inventor. Robert Gilbreth is known for his use of imagery in conveying observations about business and management. His latest book is entitled Escape from Management Hell. I asked him, just what is management hell?
It's probably a very familiar place for most of those of us who are working in 1993 in the United States. It's a place where things have gone topsy-turvy. They're a little bit wild and chaotic. Changes are happening at a very rapid pace. Top management is scurrying around trying to cope, and the rest of us are in part fearful for job security, but also hopeful that things will be changed quick enough for us to start enjoying work rather than suffering through it.
Now, what kind of changes are we seeing in American business today?
Oh, you can go right down the list, and in fact, the best place to start is probably the daily newspaper. Look at some of the corporate icons, the giants that we grew up underneath, IBM and Sears Roebuck, General Motors, are all redirecting themselves, throwing off thousands or tens of thousands of people. So downsizing is a big change. Foreign competition is another cause of change in our companies. Many of us who thought that we had a lock on a market or perhaps a competitive advantage are finding out that somewhere else someone can do it quicker or cheaper. I think the changes that technology brings are probably the most pervasive and the ones that we see the most frequently at work. Changes in the way computers are networked, this whole notion of client-server arrangements, workstations, faxes, video conferencing, all of those are really revolutionizing the way people communicate. And when you consider that communications is probably 70% of what most of us do, technology has a significant impact on changes that we experience. But it's just, of course, one of several. I think we've got different workers coming through the office doors or the plant gates today, workers who are a little bit more educated and, in particular, more expectant. They want more out of a job than just 40 hours and a paycheck. So those and many other changes are happening, in a sense, converging on corporations and even small businesses and forcing us to reconsider what the heck management is and what role different functions play within it.
Do you prepare for change? Can you prepare for change?
You can prepare on two levels. As a company, you can put into place a system that lets you recognize trends, that keeps you very focused on the outside world, which is quite new for most companies. They're typically inwardly directed, but keep your eyes and ears open as to what competitors are doing, what customers want, and prepare a sort of a pre-planned, organized response. How do we mobilize? How do we shift? How do we change our strategy or our operations without a lot of pain and a lot of delay? That's a corporate proactive approach. I think people or individuals in their careers must do much the same thing. They need to start broadening their visibility, looking at trends in other industries beyond their own, looking at what other companies and other people are doing. And chief among the messages that they'll find if they scan the environment is that they've got to learn about technology. They've got to be not only literate but also competent in the uses of new technology. To ignore technology today as an employee or a prospective job applicant is really suicide.
For many years, when people started talking about technology in terms of what to do with it in a business, they would say, well, that means we've got to put all our files on the computer. And that's it. Now, it's much more than that, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, technology does not equal computer. There are so many other things happening around technology. I mean, we're using new materials at work. We're using plastics and fine ceramics in place of steel and aluminum. We have different manufacturing processes. We have different ways to design what we're manufacturing or making or selling. We've got automated workplaces in many regards that have really very little to do with information technology. But I must admit, information technology, or IT as they call it, is the most pervasive influence in the American workplace today, and it is just creating so many challenges as well as opportunities that it's got to take top spot in any discussion.
Your book is set up to be a series of 12 stories, or parables. I almost thought parables. Why did you set it up that way?
Well, I just pay attention to what some of the leading management thinkers are saying, and that their response to what's happening in the business literature today is that there's just too many how-to books that go out of date before they're even published. How to make it through job stress, how to be a good persuader, how to survive the recession, how to start a small business, and it just goes on and on ad nauseum. And people read them, and they really don't get much out of them. They're very prescriptive and narrowly focused. And I think it was Warren Bennis that exclaimed the dearth of storytelling. He said, where are the enduring lessons that people can take to heart? And that's what I've attempted to do with Escape from Management Hell. Give parables that contain a gem or two or a word or two of wisdom that transcend whatever may be happening today or tomorrow and, you know, the very temporary circumstances that we all face. I think it'll be much more valuable and more memorable to the reader and hopefully help make a significant change in their viewpoints.
There were a number of points to each of the stories. Let's talk about some of them. In the first one, you're talking about Hammurabi and talking about management where you attempt to have too much control. Why don't you tell that story?
Well, it's one of 12, and basically the background is 12 executives, very senior people, men and women, crash in an airplane, and they end up in management hell. In order to escape, they've got to tell a very revealing story that demonstrates their mistakes on earth, their management errors to the devil. And the first one begins with the story of Hammurabi, who those of you who study law or history know that he was one of the first lawgivers back in ancient Babylonian times, about 3,000 years ago. Hammurabi made these very specific codes of conduct, and it covered everything from, you know, how you must wear your robe in a prudent fashion to what price chicken wings should bring on the marketplace. And he had all of his people follow the rules. Now, so far that's history, but I extended a little bit and explain some of the ramifications of a very rule-based, hierarchical, control-oriented organization, much as he had set up, and how things can go crazy and be absolutely ludicrous if you adhere strictly to the rules. And I think the application for today is that things are happening much too quickly. People are much more intelligent than to be bound by very prescriptive, rote-type procedures in the workplace. We've got to give them freedom and flexibility so they can be creative and innovative. And what that means is, for all the control freaks out there running corporations, you've actually got to give up control in order to gain more control over your corporation. That's tough for many of them to take.
One of the things that struck me is that I saw and heard so many people that I knew, not just at the highest level of management, but throughout an organization and the stories that I read. The second one has to do with relying heavily on data or too heavily on data. There is an engineer that I know that every time the system doesn't work, he gets out his books and he looks at his charts and his tables and everything, and he says, well, that can't be happening because it's right here on the chart.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a story called Those Amazing Digit Heads, and it's about a fictitious Polynesian tribe. I put them on Easter Island, and the queen is trying to make decisions, and she goes through all the paradigms. You know, she scatters bones and reads goat entrails and all that. And finally, she comes up with this marvelous management technique called let the data decide. So she does surveys and just polls her people to an extreme and follows the dictates of the polls. And I think we see that in politics as well as business. We see leaders afraid to make decisions based on intuition or on impulse or on what their heart or their soul tells them. They want to be propped up by the numbers. And you know, management by the numbers maybe produces some value, but remember when you were a kid with the paint-by-numbers kits you used to buy?
Yeah.
You know, you could complete the painting, but what did you end up with? you know, not what I'd call a creative or imaginative masterpiece.
Well, I don't know. My mother still has mine in her family room.
Is that right? I thought
the Cocker Spaniel still has a position of great importance in the family
home. She just puts that up when you visit.
I feel like she does. It wouldn't stand up to scrutiny. But this is interesting, this concept of playing it too safe or trying to find the right answer. Don't make any mistakes. This is a concept that really doesn't work in an innovative, changing workplace, does it?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, that's the first thing that management needs to unlearn if you want to stimulate creativity or innovation, which are two very high values in today's marketplace. And the first thing we have to do is drive out fear and let people make mistakes. We have punished people too long for not doing things right the first time, that they're not doing anything, or they're doing only what is safe. And it's even worse today with such a poor labor market when, you know, if you're fired or laid off, you really have very little refuge in the rest of the community. So it's even worse than it was. People are looking for innovation and creativity, but they're driving it out with all these fear and all these rote prescriptive procedures that they place upon folks.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Robert Gilbreth, the CEO of Proudfoot Change Management, a London-headquartered international consulting firm, and author of the book Escape from Management Hell. One of the points that you make is one that I think we have to grapple with on a daily basis, and that's the concept of teamwork versus consensus.
Oh, yeah.
How do we make decisions? Yeah. Where do we fall in a hole, and where do we do it? Get it right?
You remember Hammurabi, the first story, where he made all the decisions right down to the last detail. You can go the opposite extreme, and that's the story, The Lost Cult of Consensus. Consensus is one of those real hot buzzwords in business today. Everyone's talking about let's have teams, and let's perhaps be like the Japanese ringi system where we get people to agree on everything. I took that to another extreme, just to kind of parody the evils of consensus, and described a middle American, sort of an Aztec group of people, a cult, who everybody had to agree on everything from what food they ate, what art they produced, how they defended themselves. And you can imagine what happened. They ended up having the most humble food, the most tasteless festivals, the most ineffective armies and so forth, because they tried to satisfy every single person involved. We have leaders that take that approach, and we end up with consensus mediocrity. There has to be a balance between people who take chances and people who try to bring the rest along with them. And I think the problem we have in business today is we've got followers of both tracks, those who want to be autocrats and those who want to be democrats. And there's got to be a common ground between them somewhere.
So you attempt to reach consensus, and then when you get to a certain point, you say, okay, boys, we're going to go over here.
That's right, yeah. I mean, otherwise we just sit and wait and wait and wait until we're all dead. You know, if you wait long enough, you can always get a few more facts and study it one more time and play another what-if game or a simulation. But, you know, you get to a point where action is more important than precision.
I have this sort of pet theory that everyone sits around, and I've certainly helped do this and develops lots of data and charts and reasoning and logic. And finally, when you're all sitting around the table and it's time to make the decision, the last step is always an emotional one. We either just want to do it
or we
don't.
Sure.
Is that true?
That's right. And it might be the same thing you walked in with before you saw all the numbers. Sometimes that's really a process that's there more for making people feel comfortable with a decision that they've already decided must be taken.
I do know that the numbers do discourage you. I mean, if they say, this is just not going to work as much as I'd like to do it, or as much as I didn't like to do it, it just makes too much sense. But there is this emotional element, and no one really talks about that.
Yeah, that's right, because we don't know how to quantify it or measure it or put it in our machines.
Now, along the same line of sort of the emotional or psychological makeup of humans, one of your stories had to do with shame as a management skill.
Yes.
Tell that.
Well, we never learn about shame we don't learn much about morals in business school or wherever we learn to be managers or to take charge of people. And I really think the aftermath of decisions is just as important as the decisions themselves. So much of what we learn is to maximize cash flow, to make more money for the company, to take into account the needs of the stockholders or the owners. And so little is really answers the question, what does it mean? What are we doing? What are we leaving behind for society or for our employees or those affected by our decisions? Some people call this ethics. I prefer more powerful terms and stronger stories. So I wrote one in sort of an Edgar Allan Poe style, in which a person who has been extremely successful, a very high-ranking and well-rewarded chief executive, comes to grips with the implications of all that has made him successful. And he is quite ashamed and should be. And once he admits his shame, he's a much better person. I think humility is really in short order in American business circles today, and I really believe that if some of our leaders learned that they were not perfect and that they're not always expected to be exact, that maybe they'd be a little freer with their praise and more responsive to the needs of the community than they have been.
One of my favorite topics has to do with daring. You have to dare to do something, a company that's going to grow or to do something, and I have to dare. And when you dare, you risk making mistakes, or you're not really daring. That's not daring, to take the really safe way all the time. And the result of making mistakes is that you have the embarrassment of having made a large mistake, and you're also subject to criticism. Does that happen a lot in the management?
Oh, it does. That's... You know, another way to discuss this notion of pervasive fear, and that locks people into doing only that which is considered safe or acceptable. And I just find it absolutely hilarious. I used to find it sad, but now I just laugh at it. The executives or people in charge of the organization will say, we want innovation. We want creativity. Why can't I get an original thought around this place? How come no one is coming up with something our competitors did? Oh, and by the way, don't do anything different, don't think any differently, and don't make any mistakes. Now, other than that, go out and be courageous and daring and risk-taking. You can't have both. You can't have control and innovation together. You cannot have a risk-free environment and come up with dynamite or dynamic new products and services.
Now, you talked about the killer bees as an example of how consulting got started.
Yeah, this is kind of a tale on my own profession, management consulting. But
I wanted to say, you kind of throwing a stone at yourself there, weren't you?
Well, sure. I mean, I live in a glass house. I've thrown 11 of them. The 12th or 13th might be at least towards my business. The killer bees are people who just learn buzzwords, and all they do is buzz around with the latest fad or management trend, like business process reengineering. That's all we're hearing about today.
Ooh.
I wonder how long that'll be around. Before that, it was total quality management. Now people are saying that's perhaps not adequate for today's time. You know, our strategic planning was in there at one time. Consensus, diversity, holistic approaches. You name it, they usually last about 15 days. People who pick up on those and do not want to do the deep reading or the dedicated study to find out what it all means and what its implications are, in my view, very, very dangerous people, and we shouldn't be paying attention to them. They're the killer bees we got to watch out for.
In your consulting practice, you deal internationally with many companies from many countries. How is American business different from businesses in other countries?
Well, it's probably best to compare them with European counterparts and maybe perhaps with those in the Far East or in Asia. We're different from the Europeans in that we are more risk-taking. We have a bias towards action. We just want to do things. We want to do them now. Whereas most European cultures are fairly analytical, more conservative, traditional bound, and reserved. So we've got a leg up on them in the innovation sweepstakes. We don't like to say no. We like to see things happen, whereas they're more prone to say leave things as they are. On the other hand, the Europeans appear to be a little bit more broadly educated than American businessmen and women. They seem to have read the classics. They understand literature. They understand music and history, other than just the bottom line, strategic planning, and how to do a Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet, which is sort of our forte. On the other side of the world, across the other ocean, looking into Asia, I think we face people who are very determined and more intense at their work. They see work as being really a major portion of their life, and they work well together, whereas we are kind of individualistics. We're sort of cowboys in a sense, the last rugged individualists in the industrialized world. So there are some very quick generalizations that are probably prone to error all over the place, but you asked for them, Moira. You got them.
My guest today is Robert Gilbreth. He founded the International Change Management Practice for Arthur Andersen and Company and is appearing in the video series Winning Through Change, produced by the American Management Association. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. In the end, you talk about reaching the limits of management. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, the whole notion of what is management is under deep questioning today, and I'll tell you why. It's because we based management science from some theories and principles developed in the early part of this century, only about 70 years ago, let's say the 1920s. People like Frederick W. Taylor and Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, early industrial engineers, broke the work down into its finite pieces, real simple tasks, and then that they assumed that sort of unsophisticated, uneducated people would come in from the rural communities and work in the factories and needed to be managed. So this whole notion of management is a fairly new idea. I mean, back in the old days of craftspeople and guilds, there wasn't a management culture or management class. So we've invented it, and we've invented it because people were assumed to be too stupid or too uncaring to take work upon themselves in an organized fashion. Now, that's worked very well, this management from a few smart people at the top with a whole bunch of unsophisticated workers doing simple repetitive tasks at the bottom. Built a lot of automobiles that way, built a lot of computers that way, and refrigerators and so forth. But now we're saying, wait a minute. People are smarter than they used to be. They're more, they're not afraid of technology. In fact, they bring technology with them. They have broad experiences and wide-ranging interests, and they can't be confined to little functional boxes doing little repetitive tasks. Let's empower these people. Let's give them some authority and responsibility. Let's broaden their work scopes and let them have a little more freedom. And you know what? That is working. It's working all over the world, this notion of transferring the function of management from some stand-apart, arm's-length people to the ones actually performing the work. When that happens, and many times that's enabled with information technology, when that happens, we look around and we say, wait a minute, what are all these managers doing standing around here? They've sort of become obsolete. So that's the limit of management. It is to actually superimpose management back on the workers so that they can be in charge of what they do, how they think, and how they respond to the needs of their customers or their competitors.
So in that sense, all of the employees or the members of the group, however that works, each of those people are taking more responsibility now for themselves and are encouraged to, in fact.
That's right. Self-managed work teams is one of those buzz phrases we've heard in the last few years. accountability at lower levels, responsibility for your own group or your own actions. People are taking responsibility for wide ranges of services rather than one little task or one little function. And that's a very healthy sign. It's good for the corporation because it makes it more responsive to the customer needs, and it's also very good for the individual. It's a more enlightened place to work, with a more enjoyable work style.
Certainly seems more rewarding on a personal basis.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, there's some risks. And one of the major risks is the Hammurabis of the world don't want to give up that control. They want to be watching and dishing out information on a need-to-know basis. They want to be pigeonhole people. They want to make sure that everyone is doing things to strict procedures. They're worried about quality. The control freaks don't like that empowerment. They see it taking something away from them and from the company.
I think the example you were using of Hammurabi was very good for me in that I understood for the first time that you can have control freaks or whatever you want to call them making very specific instructions about how to do this and how to do that. And it just might work if you only have 4 people or 20 people or 30 people and you're doing a very defined kind of a task or service or making a very small product. But as the company gets larger and larger and larger, and when you make a dictum about what kind of how you need to order supplies in California. And in fact, you have an office in Singapore, and supplies aren't that easy to come by there. These rules can really fall apart and end up really driving the company into a hole.
Oh, yeah, they'll hamstring the company. And you know what happens is people start to break the rules because people are smart and they're more interested in getting the work done and serving their customer or fulfilling their quotas or what have you than following some silly rule. And when you see the rules broken a lot, it's a signal not that we have a lot of rule breakers, but probably we have a lot of interesting, dynamic people who are being held back by the rules. Rules only work if they leverage the skills, talent, and energy of people. If they don't do that, if they block them or suppress them, then they need to be thrown out or modified.
How did you decide which issues to take up in your stories?
Boy, I looked at some of the major sins in business, some of the most egregious faults of businessmen and women, and it was tough because I originally had 28 stories, and to figure out which was worse was kind of a toss-up. My publisher and I went back and forth and said, no, I like this one, no, I like that one. And I guess it's just as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, when it gets right down to it, it's an emotional decision. What do you think people would like to read about? And what I'm finding is people who are reading Escape from Management Hell are saying, I was in that book. I remember that guy. That guy was my boss, or that was my coworker. Or they'll say, have you been looking at my company? Because we live exactly that way. So I look for problems and solutions or cultures that, you know, most people could relate to very quickly and feel that they have either been there or they're fixing to get out of there.
Yeah. One corporation with which so many Americans identify is IBM. It's the epitome of a large, successful American corporation, which has made it internationally. And with its recent troubles, I've heard people actually say, but I thought we could depend on IBM. It was always going to be there, and it was going to be more successful every year. And any misstep would be a small misstep and easy to recover from. Well, now everyone has been watching Louis Gerstner, the new head of IBM, to see what he's going to do. And he was quoted in last week's Wall Street Journal as saying, there's been a lot of speculation as to when I'm going to deliver a vision of IBM. The last thing IBM needs right now is a vision. Instead, he said, IBM needs textbook blocking and tackling, lower costs and better market focus in every division. You also were quoted in that article. Tell us your reaction to what he has to say.
Well, my reaction was shock. I could not believe that a man has been at the helm of one of the most prestigious, technologically advanced, and well-known companies in the world. He's been there for 90 days when he made this statement. This was his first public appearance. And after 90 days, the only thing he could say is, I don't know where we're going, and I don't need to know where we're going. All we have to do is cut costs and heads, and we'll be okay. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, I was shocked that this would come out of somebody in such a responsible position. We all are interested in IBM as consumers by virtue of their products and services. He said nothing about those. He's had nothing in his message that lifted or ennobled his employees, those 270,000 or so people around the world who have been waiting for the other shoe to drop and drop and drop for the last 5 years, who've seen their stock market or their stock prices plummet from $175 to $47 in just a span of a year or two. I think a vision is something that has to compel people to be different, to change, and to move into the future with opportunity and excitement. And it must be rational. It should be based on numbers, of course. It should presume we'll have a profitable company. But it also should be compelling and ennobling. It should make people want to get up and go to work in the morning. It should make customers comfortable that someone is going to be there to service their mainframes, or that when they buy their PCs with the IBM label, it won't be made by some other company who doesn't care. I was shocked, Moira, to be honest with you. And I found myself sort of outspoken when so many other management consultants were what I would consider sycophantic. They were running around saying, well, he's the boss of IBM, I guess he's okay. I wonder how many of them are looking for jobs with IBM as consultants in the future. I know I certainly shouldn't.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Maura. My pleasure.
My guest today has been Robert Gilbreth. He is the CEO of Proudfoot Change Management, a London-headquartered international consulting firm, and he's the author of Escape from Management Hell, published by Barrett Kohler. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn. From his early days at Westinghouse through his founding of three technology companies, Jim Ferguson's inventions permeate American life. From watches and thermometers, portable computers and television screens, it started with the liquid crystal display, or LCD. Since then, he has received 90 patents for his inventions. I asked Jim if he had envisioned being this creative when he first started.
I don't think anybody knows what the future holds. I always envisioned myself being a scientist rather than an inventor when I was going to school. When I got out and decided to go to work instead of finish up my schooling, well, I kind of said, well, I'll work for a while for Westinghouse and go back and get my doctorate, and never did.
You never looked back.
Never looked back.
So this is after your bachelor's degree.
Yes.
Now, out of school, you first went to work for Westinghouse, and certainly Westinghouse should be considered a haven for inventors, having been founded by George Westinghouse. Tell us about your experience there.
Well, Westinghouse is great. I started out working in vacuum tubes. Incidentally, they'll come back someday, but...
Prediction from the inventor.
But I've kind of given up on them for a while. Started making vacuum tubes, and then got an opportunity to go to the research labs. And as part of that, going to the research labs, I got an opportunity to look at a problem they were having in measuring temperature, and got an opportunity to look at liquid crystals. I started doing some research, and the more I dug, the more I became fascinated. At that point in time, I decided that was a way to measure temperature. You see the results, I think, of some of that work that we did at Westinghouse at that time. I had the first group in industry working with liquid crystals. We developed the little forehead thermometer, fever thermometer that you buy in the stores. We've developed a liquid crystal for that. You see a lot of them as mostly novelties, but some of them are used in critical conditions. One of the most accurate ways of measuring temperature that's available, really, is very sensitive to temperature because of the low energy that it takes to operate them.
Now, what are liquid crystals? I'm not totally clear about that.
A lot of people have asked that same question. In the early days, even people said there are no such things as liquid crystals.
Lucky for you, there was.
luckily, they were wrong. Organic molecules have shape. They're not all round and nice spherical things, but have many times elongated shapes, and they're bound very weakly so that a lot of times the bonding between the molecules can cause them to be a liquid, but their shape won't let them rotate freely. What happens is that the long axis of the molecules remain parallel, at least over some of the temperature range where they're liquid. So what you have, basically, the simplest form, is a liquid which has order. We have a term for it called scalars. They can be influenced, and since they're a liquid, it just takes a little bit of energy to move them around.
Okay, now you really lost me here, so I'm going to have to ask you some questions. First of all, if we're thinking of the crystals, we're thinking of elongated shapes that, in a sense, like a bowl full of toothpicks.
Right.
It's like it's liquid in that it can move. You can put your hand in there and kind of stir it, but it's not a real liquid. It's kind of a different kind of a liquid. And that when it's in certain temperature ranges, they actually line up. And when they line up, does that mean that they have a different color or a different sensitivity?
They have the power to affect light in different ways. For instance, we have dyes which absorb only under a particular direction of polarized light. And these are called polarizers like you use in your sunglasses. And if you take two polarizers and cross them, it cancels out. we can put one of these magic polarizing dyes in an electric crystal and then use an electric field to control the direction of the dye. So we can make it turn into a polarizer and not into a polarizer. So we can manage the properties of the material. We can make them be waveguides. That is, like, we can make them guide light in different directions. Now, if the molecules are in the direction of the vibrations, they have one effect. If they're in the direction opposite to that, or 90 degrees to that, they have another. So actually what happens is a light travels in two different speeds going through with the polarization.
One polarization versus the other. So that's how you end up with a display. That one portion is polarized one way and another portion is polarized another way. And so then you can see the dark versus the light. Now, everybody has seen liquid crystal displays everywhere, but not everybody knows what they're looking at. Describe for our listeners just, you know, what an LCD is and how they recognize one.
Well, I'm sure that everybody sees at least a few of them every day. The commonest LCD would be on your calculator. I haven't seen a calculator with anything but an LCD for years now. All the new calculators have a twisted pneumatic. We call it a twisted pneumatic LCD. And what a TN LCD is that it's really a light guide, that takes polarized light and causes it to rotate 90 degrees.
What we're looking at in those kind of displays is just sort of a flat background with maybe light gray. And then when you see the numbers, you might see them in dark gray. But it's a very flat-looking field, right?
Yes.
And when you turn it, as I recall, when I look at my calculator in the wrong light or I turn it in a particular light, it's a little hard to see. It's like you have to kind of see it straight on. Is that right?
Well, there is what we call an angle of view.
Ah.
Which is fairly complex, but it has to do with the waveguiding again. Now, the dark and the light, of course, is the dark is crossed polarizers and the light is parallel polarizers. So it's just that simple. What the liquid crystal does is it either forms a light guide that rotates the plane of polarization by 90 degrees or doesn't, depending on whether we put an electric field on it.
You received a patent on this, but you had problems actually getting that patent, right?
Well, not getting a patent. What happened, actually, was that we filed our patent after some difficulties. Finally ended up getting a patent in January, and an overseas company got the patent and was first through the door in Switzerland in December. However, our patent was much more complete, had more disclosure, and also I had published an article earlier in a journal which mentioned the property which gave rise to the twisted pneumatic. And their disclosure, in the U.S. at least, was not acceptable over the prior art. So there was no problem in the U.S. Even if there would have been problems in the U.S., we would have been first to invent. We were clearly the first ones to think of it. So we would not have had a problem in the United States getting a patent. However, in the world, it's a different story, where the first to invent gets a patent, and in some countries where there's not very much examination, the patent goes to the guy that gets there first.
First to file,
yes. It's a problem that we have now in that we're trying to get our system closer to the world system. And my general advice to people that's in this business, if you have a good idea and if it looks good to you, you're really proud of it, tell your patent attorney to hurry up and get it in the patent office, even if the disclosure is not what you'd like, because you can change that. But if somebody else beats you to the patent office in a foreign country like Japan, you can be in big trouble.
Many people, they invent and they've got a good idea, and they have to bring it to, you know, fruition, so they implement it. And they file a patent in the United States, and that only protects them in the United States.
That's correct.
Do they have to go to all the other countries to patent?
Yes, you do.
So every country individually that you want to patent in, you've got to get there first.
Yes. I've got 44 nations that I've
file. That know your name.
I don't know whether they know it, but we've filed in 44 different countries for some of our, what we consider the most important cases. Most patents don't really come to fruition for a number of reasons. A lot of them are just not well thought out in terms of marketing, and that's one of the things that we try to do. No matter how much of a hurry we are to get it in, we always like to look, well, what if it does issue? Is it gonna be worthwhile?
Uh-huh.
I figure by this time, who's counting?
Now, you founded your first company, Elixo, in the 70s, and there seems to be an essential link between inventors and entrepreneurs. What are the problems that can happen when an inventor, to make everything work, has to become an entrepreneur?
Well, one of the things about inventors, I think they're from all walks of life. And a successful inventor can be a housewife or a doctor of robotics or whoever. It just is what happens to be going on at the time and the base of knowledge, and you see something that needs to be done and capitalize on it. Can be real simple things. I think the capitalization on it always depends on some money.
Yep.
And when you start out, unless you happen to be born in the right family, you're always going to need money. And to get money, you're going to have to persuade somebody that you have a good idea. One of the things that a lot of inventors get into is this paranoia. Well, if I tell somebody about it, I'm going to lose it because they're going to steal my idea. Well, that's why the patent laws are there. So the first and best thing is to spend a few bucks and get something on file and get it in the office so that it's there. Then the next thing you do is make sure it's going to be as good as you think it is. You do a little bit more reading, research, find out what the market is. And then after you get a good idea of what it's worth in terms of dollars, because the guy you're going to sell it to doesn't care much about
your invention
ego.
Per se.
he really wants to know what he can get out of it. So you have to persuade him that by investing his dollars, he's going to be able to make a profit. And that's planning. It's just all in the world it is. It's going out, finding out where the market is, and then arriving at a plan to address that market. How do you get to it? Do you have personal contacts to it, or do you have to hire another guy? Do you have to tell somebody else about what you got so he can sell it for you? And I think this is something that gets you very quickly to becoming an entrepreneur. You're really out there. You've got this great idea, and you see that everybody needs it. You have to take risks to get it there. Most times, the world doesn't beat a path to your door if you do have a better mousetrap, because everybody else has a mousetrap, too, that they think is better. I think one thing that contributed most to the success of the LCD, and there was a form of LCD on the market called a dynamic scattering for just to try to go on the market, but it was not successful before I started selling mine. The thing that really contributed to it was the LED, the little light-emitting diode that James Bond showed on his wrist back in the 70s, or 69, I guess, or something. They saw this, and everybody had to have a digital watch and red digits, until they found out you had to have a battery dispenser on your arm to keep the batteries in the watch. Yet watch batteries were never intended to operate that much power. Anyway, we were there with a vacuum, and digital watches had been sold, and there was nothing to build a digital watch with. So we came in, gave them the answer to their, what do we do to make this thing work? And had a market very quickly that was too big for us, actually. It took much too large to finance with a small company. But it turned into a huge success because now, of course, you can buy a watch module that'll last for 5 years with virtually no attention.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Jim Ferguson, inventor of the LCD, the liquid crystal display. There's a couple of things that are interesting to me. The first thing is that the fortuitous cross of this sort of scientific physical invention with what the world was ready for. You know, James Bond had LED display in his watch, and we're all ready. The market was ready. Whereas if you had maybe built a couple of these watches, people might say, well, I don't like the look of that. I mean, it was wonderful. If you can get Sean Connery to do anything today, I'm sure it'll get that there is a certain amount of luck involved.
Oh, yes. It's I prefer to call it timing.
There we go. Sorry. There's certain timing involved.
There were several other factors. If you remember, that was also the time of CMOS.
No, I didn't remember that. It's the time of CMOS.
CMOS
go ahead.
Came along, and CMOS was very low power. But what good's low power if you haven't got anything that can be driven at low power to have to convert everything up with
So your low-power display then could be powered by the CMOS.
Directly from CMOS. So we were able to take advantage of the CMOS revolution. So we were in a way shockwave riders, you know. We had that future shock all going with us, and it allowed us to put a display on the market that was capable of using the capabilities of CMOS semiconductor devices. And so we had it all together. We had a market which Sean Connery had inadvertently given us. It was not their intent to give us this market. We had the tools to drive the stuff. So, you know, if it had been earlier, the earlier technology, which used all kinds of power, wouldn't have been useful. And we had our invention at the right time, at the right place, and away it went.
So actually, this invention at a different time might not have made boo.
I think it would have made boo.
Eventually.
But it would have been on a longer time track, I believe. The time track on Twisted-O-Matic was very, very good. It's been growing and still growing at about a 20 to 25% annual growth rate, consolidated annual growth rate.
For how many years?
Well, almost since day one. There was a few hiccups, but...
how long ago was that? 20 years ago?
Yes, it's started selling in 1972, I believe.
So it's just about 20 years.
So...
Now, do you still have patent coverage for that? Do your patents run out?
My patents... I had a black armband day back in May of 1990. Actually, there's still some patents out there. One of the things I did also when I... started with this. I didn't file just one patent. I didn't try to get one patent that covered it and then go away. We had a way to align a surface, which was what I thought was much better and is the type still used to this day. I had the polymer seal for the device, which is the way they're still doing it today.
And those are later patents.
Well, they were part of the package. When we decided that this was a good idea, instead of stopping with one patent, I put together a package of patents, like sort of like a tree. We had the base patent, and then we patented the idea of using a matrix drive for multiplexing, and we patented how to align it with the background. If you put an ordinary white background on a liquid crystal, it doesn't work very well, so we had the non-depolarizing background. The light, if you look at your watch, most of them have little light backlights in them. We patented that. So we put together a package which was not just the invention of the base idea, but all those things which would go into building this thing, plus a bunch of the applications. The result was that it was a pretty ironclad
set of patents. A lot of protection. Now, you were associate director of the Liquid Crystal Institute at Kent State University during the, and how many of us remember, the 1970 Kent State student protests. In fact, your institute was part of the protest.
We had government contracts, of course, as most universities did that day, and the students were protesting that we were. I think the rumor was started that we had helped find Kay Kavera in the jungles of South America. And it was an unfortunate rumor. It was an unfortunate rumor to start.
What was it like during those days? I mean, the National Guard was on campus. The students were protesting.
Well, it wasn't very nice. We had a tank sitting in the parking lot.
Could you go to work?
I didn't go to work. It wasn't encouraged. It was, in fact, strongly discouraged. You had to have a special pass to get on campus. Your identification was checked. You felt like you were in someplace else besides
the United
Ohio.
States, Ohio.
Especially Ohio. But to have troops in a town of that size, and it was really pretty bad. They had a pretty close security for a while, and it was a mess. It was not very pretty. I think the main problem, looking back at it, was the difference wasn't the fact that Kent was a very activist school. It was just that the difference between the local citizenry and the school was so great. And the National Guard came from the neighboring town, and many of them looked at the students as draft dodgers and things of that type.
Not particularly pleased.
So they were very conservative in their outlook, and the students were moderately liberal in theirs, and they had a core of course, very, very strong
protesters,
yeah. People who were very radical in their outlook and view, so that the combination of that was powder keg.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Jim Ferguson, inventor of the LCD, the liquid crystal display. Let me go back to the experience that you had when you had filed and received your U.S. patent for the LCD, and yet there was a company, did you say in Europe, that had filed a month before?
That led to a rather large lawsuit. we filed our patent, and Roche, they came to us and said they had deep pockets and that they were going to we were going to have an interference and that they would keep us in the patent department forever. I wasn't frightened by that because I knew that if there was only one patent at stake, they might make some small attempt at that, but under the circumstances, I was well covered, and nobody was going to be able to do anything with it anyway. We had purposely set out to fix ourselves so that we didn't just have one patent. We had several patents, so they not only had to go around the main patent, but they had to find an application that they could use and a few things like that. So that wasn't a big threat to us, but they made the threat. But being a small company and underfinanced, we had to do something. So, and we also couldn't afford to prosecute the patents in Europe and Asia, so we made a deal with them for $1 million, which was to be paid in $500,000 chunks. And they paid the first one and then refused to pay the second one because there was a claim made against the thing by Timex and Kent State University. Through Timex was the instigator. So we had to fight not a patent infringement, but interference with contractual rights and ownership fight, which we settled on our basis. And finally, after about 3 years and having to sell my first company, which was called Elixco, we did finally get them to live up to their contract. it was a battle.
I think this is what I'm talking about when I say when an inventor has to become an entrepreneur. I mean, you really feel like my time is best spent back here while I can invent a few more things. But you're up there dealing with with sophisticated attorneys and corporations and letters and court appearances and that type of thing.
The amount of trouble you have is directly proportional to how big the market is. If they perceive it as a big market,
watch
you
out.
You got problems. I mean, especially if it's an international market, you really got problems. You find that things happen that you wouldn't normally run into. But so far, we've been able to come out a little bit ahead in these things and keep going. I tell everybody I'm a kind of a masochist since this is my third company that I've started. I find that no matter what, starting a small company and making the jobs and all that sort of thing that go with it is really a very rewarding thing to do.
Well, what are you working on now?
Well, several things, but mostly eye protection. And we've had a couple of very interesting things. One is an auto-darkening welding lens, which is now being produced and marketed actually worldwide. We just started selling it in Europe recently and have been selling it in Asia for about a year.
So this is so the welder doesn't have to, like, hit his head to get that shield down.
That's correct. It's not just a substitute for a welding helmet. It's something that makes welding more higher productivity and easier and better. If you're doing precision welding or if you're doing tack welding where you're making a lot of welds, getting the helmet up and down is a real chore, and it also can cause you to get a stiff neck. So, although it's good for the chiropractors,
it's not
so good for the welder.
There you go.
So we've been very successful in introducing this. We're also have introduced devices for laser protection. We do some nonlinear optics and some variable wavelength filtering, that sort of thing.
So you can wear glasses and the laser won't come out at you?
Won't get through. The problem with lasers, especially pulsed lasers, is that you probably read in the New York Times or someplace about lasers as weapons. That is that if you have a very short pulse laser, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of energy to permanently damage the eye. It, in fact, takes about 5 microjoules to cause a lesion to form in the back of the eye. And at about 20 microjoules, it causes the eye to bleed internally and do all kinds of nasty things to fix it. Well, somebody came along with dye lasers and a few things like that, so you don't know what color the light's going to be from the laser, what wavelength it's going to be. So you need a variable wavelength protection to make up for the fact that this is happening. These are actually called agile lasers because frequency agile. So that's what we were working on. It doesn't take much of a shot when you really consider it to really do damage because it gets focused right back on the back of the eye. I guess what happens, it causes the liquid to boil in the back of the eye. It's just like a little explosion back there.
Gosh.
It really can be nasty.
Might be those lasers. It's not that I'm getting old. My eyesight's going, huh, Jim?
Well, I'm not too crazy about looking at them myself.
Yeah. Okay, I have one last question, Jim. Do you think you're ever going to retire?
I don't know.
I know.
I always say I'm
going
to retire. It's a manana kind of thing. manana never comes.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest today has been Jim Ferguson, inventor of the LCD, the liquid crystal display. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. 855-859-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.